Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 8th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from the show This Is Revolution, Pascal Robert will be here to look back on the week that was. Also on the program today, Senate confirms Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. Russian missile strikes a train station used to evacuate civilians from the Donbass region. At least 50 are dead. Peace talks, meanwhile, stall. Belarus demands to take part in them. Senate decides to punt on the already anemic $10 billion in COVID aid until they return after Easter. Meanwhile, Omicron infections on the rise. New York Attorney General seeks to hold Donald Trump in contempt. And the FBI is to investigate how classified materials ended up visiting Mar-a-Lago. Half a million Puerto Ricans without power on day three of a power outage. And a top former RNC staffer gets 12 years in prison for child porn convictions, specifically infant porn.
Jesus.
Alabama votes to criminalize transgender health care to push a don't say gay bill. House Oversight Chair says the DOJ is obstructing its Trump investigation. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Friday, casual Friday. Joining me as always, Emma Viglin.
Hello. Happy casual Friday.
Happy casual Friday indeed. We just got an IM saying from I Far Did. Hallelujah, MR. I was getting so fed up with the old on hold music from Beat Cops. That was not from Beat Cops. I think that was from Pilot Season. And, but yes, understood. And thanks for changing things up. Well, we got that. What was the name of the,
we played the new music yesterday. Yeah.
Is that the music that we played?
Yeah. We played the new intro from, Cinco Sanders.
Cinco Sanders. And,
it's a bit groovy. It was like a surfer thing. Music.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about music.
I Far Did also writes on Jesus. A similar note, I greatly miss the old outro song, No, No, No. That is the song La Poupée. And for, I don't know when we switched, 3 or 4 years ago.
It was whenever YouTube started clamping down on copyright really hard.
Right. And we used to, it's a long story how we got into this habit, but we had our outro song for the entire show was La Poupée. And
between the fun half and the first
half. Oh, is that what it was? Okay.
Yeah. So we play Pilot at the end.
And La Poupée, which is a French song that was like a scratch track for Bad Situationist at one point, this movie I did that never released, really. And it turns out that La Poupée was one of the most covered songs in like the history of the world.
Oh, wow.
And so we had everybody, like almost on a daily basis, people would send in like, Japanese versions, Jimi Hendrix, like
I still don't think we played all of them.
Oh, no way. And
it must be fair use at this point. So they really were like coming after you for copyright?
No, not the recordings. Like the song, maybe.
Yes, but the song, maybe, but not the recordings.
Oh.
And in fact, in Boston, Ted Leo, who is going to be doing music for the Boston show, is, I think he's going to do a La Poupée.
Wow.
That's incredible.
And he's going to do a Pilot Light. And oh, and I don't think he knows this, but he knows the guy who wrote Pilot Light. They've worked together in a band. Mm-hmm. I just I went out with that and Dave Derby. I've been meaning to email Ted about that. Folks, all right, let's get into this. Ketanji Brown Jackson was confirmed yesterday in the Senate. We will talk to Pascal about his sense of both the implications of the appointment to the extent that there is one and her credentials. He's an attorney. And but by any way you slice it, it marks a turning point in the history of the country. It is the first time, not only is it the first time that a black woman has sat on the Supreme Court or will sit on the Supreme Court, it will also be the first time in the nation's history where the majority of people sitting on the court will not be white men. I think you still have plurality.
Yeah.
White men. But nevertheless.
Right. So it's Elena Kagan, Sotomayor, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Clarence Thomas, and
Amy Coney Barrett.
Wow. But
thank God Brett Kavanaugh is there to represent me.
Yes. There you go.
Feel seen?
It is just another example of woke culture where white guys just cannot get a break. Here is that vote tally.
On this vote, the yeas are 53, the nays are 47, and this nomination is confirmed.
You can see there the Republican members of the Senate walking out.
Except for Mitt Romney, who's seen there standing.
Walking out like the Pistons after they lost to Michael Jordan.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. And Chuck Schumer down there is going like this.
Yes, Chuck Schumer is getting overexcited. And there's two things I want to note. Mitt Romney's dad, George Romney, was in addition to being the president of American Motors, I think it was at the time, or at one point, was also governor of Michigan, and was a little bit ahead of his time in terms of supporting MLK and the civil rights movement at that time, and sort of stuck his neck out a little bit relative to who he was and in that time in terms of supporting civil rights. So not terribly surprised that Mitt Romney's not going to leave that the building in that moment. The other thing you should note is that apparently things took an extra half an hour to vote because Rand Paul and Lindsey Graham, in a sign of, like, I think,
open disrespect.
Well, a purposeful disrespect, didn't dress in a suit. And frankly, you know, I don't like wearing suits, but apparently to be a senator, you need to wear a suit to get on. There's like a dress code to get in the floor of the Senate, which I don't think I was aware of. And so they did this obviously as a way of just saying, hey, we really want to show our disrespect here. And it really is more of a statement. Not only are they lowlifes in some respect, but how diseased their voters are.
Yeah.
In the mind. Like, we really need to see you guys disrespect this black woman who is being appointed to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Flip her off in your PJs. That's what we vote on.
Exactly. I mean, this is what they need to maintain their bona fides. And this is, you know, and part of the reason why they just need to show a blanket disrespect is because the Republicans never came up with a narrative that would work in any way with Ketanji Brown Jackson. They attempted to push this whole pedophilia thing, which was really as much of a sop to their QAnon base as it was an attack on her.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still trying. Here's Jesse Waters doing his best Bill O'Reilly impersonation.
I just wanted to show this, though, really quickly, though. Her face when she gets the vote, it's 6 seconds. I mean, we just really, really quick, just because I think it is important to show this. Like, I mean, this is a historic moment. It's
there she is.
Right. It's beautiful, right? So keep
all right.
going.
So anyways, they have been struggling to come up with a theme as to how they can how they could attack Ketanji Brown Jackson. And in addition to then the outright disrespect that Rand Paul and Lindsey Graham went after in terms of just not dressing so that they could get on the floor of the Senate to vote and slowing things down, making a stink of it. And like I say, the pedophilia attacks were as much of a sop to their QAnon base as anything else. These are people who are running for president, so they've got to appeal to the base of the Republican Party. Here's Jesse Waters with his attempt at, both imitating Bill O'Reilly and attacking the hypocrisy. Did you know that Abraham Lincoln was a Republican? That's one of these. That's where I would file this in. Go ahead.
I'll appreciate. But Democrats also blocked who would have been the first black woman on the Supreme Court, Janice Rogers Brown, when Bush tried to elevate her because she was a Republican. So their intentions aren't pure.
Okay. I don't know what their intentions are pure are necessarily, but what is strange about this is that Democrats never had the opportunity to block Janice Roger Brown. I mean, she's a lunatic.
And if they had, it would have been righteous.
It would have been righteous, but it is simply a lie. She came up for a circuit court appointment early. I think it was in 2003 in the Bush years. I don't know if she was actually nominated or her nomination was blocked, but then she ultimately was nominated in 2005 for the D.C. Circuit Court. She was confirmed. There was talk that she might be nominated to the Supreme Court, but despite the fact having a 55-45, was it? Senate, Republican Senate in 2005, George Bush did not nominate her. Hmm. In fact, he nominated Harriet Myers. Now, the reason why Harriet Myers is not on the Supreme Court is because Republicans blocked her because he wasn't conservative enough. And we ended up getting Sam Alito. But it is a lie that Democrats blocked Janice Rogers Brown. I think that I would have wanted them to. She thought that we went through a socialist revolution in this country in 1937 when we got things like Social Security and 40-hour work week and a Congress that could actually, in an executive branch, that could actually do things. So,
yeah, but the Democrats blocked her in a sense because they preemptively canceled her because she was a Republican.
They preemptively
right.
canceled
her. And so Bush said he had no option, and that was the Democrats' fault.
All right. We'll bring Pascal on in just a moment. But first, a reminder, today's program sponsored by our favorite sponsor, Sunset Lake Sabade.
That is our favorite.
You get with Sunset Lake Sabade, you use the code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. They have the finest Sabade products around. All of their products are third-party tested. You can find the results of these tests on their website. They have tinctures, which I used last night to get to sleep, frankly.
Were you just singing Say Bay Day to A Bay Bay?
I was, yes.
Okay, just making sure. I was trying.
People understand why we say Say Bay Day, because we can't use the actual letters in the way they're pronounced without getting a problem with from our YouTube overlords. They have tinctures. They have smokables. They have pre-rolls. They have fudge with CBD. Gummies. They have coffee with CBD. They have balms, like a salve, if you will. Arnica and CBD salve. They have hand creams. Check it out. Wonderful products. Very helpful for sleeping. Very helpful for chilling out after. Man, Matt uses it as a subsidy for his other smokables. And it's a great company. They practice great farming practices, regenerative farming, integrated pest control. So there's no pesticides, organic fertilizer. They are great movement partners. They've donated thousands of dollars to not only to charities, but also to strike funds and to soup kitchens. Their business practices are great. $15 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. Check it out. You will not be disappointed. I have gotten such great feedback on this sponsor that I really am super proud that to be associated with these guys.
I use the tincture regularly to go to sleep.
It has been huge for me to get off of Ambien. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Pascal Robert. We are back. Sorry. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Pascal Robert. He is a an attorney and also a co-host of This Is Revolution. Pascal, thanks for joining us here, obviously, with Emma Viglin.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on with both of you.
Of course.
So a couple of things I want to talk to you about this week. I know that I had watched some clips of some things that you had put out on This Is Revolution. Let's start with KBJ. First, I want to just get your sense of her as a pick. In terms of her background in the law, like, you know, people talk about the diversity she's going to bring to the court as a Black woman. But for me, the diversity I'm interested in is that, like, she's not a prosecutor. She's not a corporate law. I mean, obviously, she's been a judge for now, you know, 10 some odd years. But
works as a public defender.
But she worked first as a public defender, court. Which yeah. is the big thing for me. So what is your... give us your sense of her, you know, in terms of her qualifications.
Well, I mean, in terms of her actual role qualifications, she's probably, without a doubt, one of the most qualified Supreme Court nominees that we've ever had. In terms of purely academics, she went to the right schools. I mean, as you guys probably know, usually if you are going to be a Supreme Court nominee, you usually have come out of the top five law schools in the country. Barring some examples, we've had, you know, in the last 50 years, we've had Supreme Court justices that came out of Northwestern. Amy Coney Barrett went to, I think she went to Notre Dame, which, yep. I mean, that's just pretty shocking in terms of the overall norm. Not to say that it's not a good law school, but I'm just saying that normatively you think that these folks come out of Harvard, Yale, Chicago, Stanford, you know, kind of Columbia, so on and so forth. But she went to Harvard. She was on a law review. She graduated with honors. So she had the academic qualifications. In terms of a legal career, she's done more judicial clerkships, not only Supreme Court clerkships, but judicial clerkships than any of the major or any of the recent Supreme Court nominees by far. She's actually done more time on the bench than many of the other nominees as well. And in terms of the actual raw qualifications as legal scholarship, judicial tenure, as clerking for courts, federal and Supreme, she's outstanding in that regard. So that qualification is one thing. In terms of her jurisprudence for my politics and I think our politics, the sad reality I have to say is that because of this so much cynicism towards the Biden presidency for a variety of factors that we can go into, particularly for many on the left and some who are even on the radical left, that, you know, Biden has disappointed in some of his ability to see through promises that he made. There's a degree of kind of cynicism about this appointment, and it's reduced to a bit of a kind of like identity politics bone that he's throwing to the black community. And I understand that sentiment because, frankly, with my politics being the kind of leftist that I am, I understand how the Democratic Party uses racial symbolism, particularly for black communities, but not exclusively, to as an actual proxy for redistributive actual policy. But to get to your actual point, Sam and I are pretty much proximate in age, and I can pretty much say this comfortably. She's the most progressive Supreme Court justice nominee in my whole life, and I can make arguments as to why she might be as, if not more, progressive than Thurgood Marshall.
Wow. I mean, that's...
Well, yeah, of course, Thurgood Marshall is a civil rights lawyer. He's the kind of case. But in terms of she basically is the most progressive he's had since Thurgood Marshall.
OK. Yeah. And I want to ask you, you know, specifically why. And just note this. And I've said this before about, I don't know, it was 10, 12 years ago. I heard Pam Carlin speak. She is a professor at Stanford and in a fairly left on the spectrum of legal minds, as it were, that have prominence in this country. You know, she would have been a good pick at one point too, but I think was outside of, you know, where the Democratic Party would go. She had said at that time, we hadn't had in decades a Supreme Court justice who got on the court and moved the court left from where it was or in terms of the person they replaced. Now, I think that you could argue maybe, you know, Sotomayor maybe, you know, changed that a little bit. But certainly KBJ has done that with Breyer. It's like the first time that it's like a hands down that seat. Is now occupied by someone to the left of the person they replaced.
Not only to the left of the person they replaced, but to the left of the traditional, very milquetoast, conservative, normative judicial picks. Let's make this abundantly clear, and I think, Sam, you appreciate it. By the way, I just want to correct something. I practice law. I'm not practicing right now, so I'm a lawyer, but I'm not actually a practicing attorney, so I don't want to misrepresent
that. In my experience, once you're a lawyer, you're always a lawyer.
Yeah, I call myself a recovering lawyer for a variety of reasons.
But yeah, it's like still calling Hillary Clinton Secretary Clinton, right? She'll have that until the day she dies. You're a lawyer, Pascal.
So the point I want to convey to you is that we have to understand that the Supreme Court is a counter-majoritarian conservative institution. What do I mean by that? This is not a Democratic institution. It is a life tenure position, and the actual judicial power of the institution is to potentially strike down congressional legislation and state legislation that is actually decided by representative bodies of people that voted for them. So it is counter-majoritarian, and by the nature of what it does, you could argue undemocratic by its nature, all right? So that being said, part of the problem that we have with the way we view the court, as well as the way we view a lot of things, we view the court and America through the lens of the New Deal norm of how this functions. What do I mean by that? People say things like, oh my God, the economy in this country is so bad. We've been so conservative as a country for the last 50 years. As you guys know, we have a theme on our show called the 50 plus year counter-revolution, which posits that since 68 and the rise of Nixon, all of American politics has been a counter-revolution against the New Deal Civil Rights Coalition, which is true. But we fail to realize is that from the rise of the New Deal, particularly around, say, 1944, we know the New Deal starts in the 30s, till 71 when we have the collapse of the Bretton Woods consensus. That is an anomaly in both American economic function and American jurisprudence, because this was a set of legal structures put in to protect capitalism from collapse in the face of massive left opposition from socialists and communists. So in other words, when you hear people say, like Donald Trump say, make America great again, he's not talking about the Lower East Side in 1913. He's talking about Ozzie and Harriet, Leave It to Beaver, and 1950, 1954. Those times weren't that great for most black people in America, but that greatness was bankrolled by a government largesse where we had the highest top marginal tax rate in American history, and basically one of the largest periods of time of government control over capitalism, finance capitalism, and the function of America. So it's always ironic that these right-wingers talking about we want to make America great again, like in the 50s, when that was the closest we had to actually socialism in the United States.
Right. You hear people refer to that as the Great Compression. Thomas Piketty argues that was like sort of an anomalous period of time in terms of like a wealth disparity. Again, obviously not great if you're a black person and want to vote or have any type of civil rights in this country. But in terms of you know, it's purely on, you know, those economic terms, that was when things had flattened the most in this country.
Right. And that was an anomaly. That's not the norm for how American capitalism functioned. Well, guess what? Because of certain political realities, the Cold War being a large part of them, that was also the period of time where we had some of the most progressive Supreme Court jurisprudential decisions, from Brown v. Board of Education, Miranda, Roe v. Wade, comes in 73, but within the same kind of construct, that basically humanizes the function of the American law legal system. It takes us away from like the worst abuses of jurisprudential pro-capitalism, like the Lochner era and all that other stuff, which are cases that are so egregiously pro like monopolistic capitalism that they to this day, you go to law school, you hear about these cases, you're like, what were these people thinking about? But we also have to realize that was done because of the fear of the United States' impression in the global South post-World War II because of the appeal of Soviet communism to global South countries. When we say global South, we mean Africa, the Middle East, China, what they used to call the third world of developing nations. So there was a strategic pivot in the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court to facilitate an amelioration in the way America was perceived in the world. And there's a really great book called Cold War Civil Rights by a woman named Mary Dudziak that really talks about how particularly this was done when it comes to Brown v. Board of Education and all of the desegregation law. To get to the point, not to belabor this, because we look at the Supreme Court through that lens of that anomaly of a period of time, we don't realize how reactionary this institution has always been. You follow what I'm saying? This is the Supreme Court, Plessy versus Ferguson, Dred Scott.
I would argue that we are, as of Amy Coney Barrett, really, as Amy Coney Barrett, I mean, we were headed in this way. We are entering into a new Lochner era. We're going to see specifically, you know, the rollback of the ability of the executive branch to do things like regulate. I think we're going to see limitations on even what the legislature can do. Like, we're getting back into that era where it's like, if we were ever to have a Medicare for all, this is a court right now, as it's constructed even today, that I think would inhibit its deployment in some fashion.
I think you're absolutely correct. I think that on the actual objective analysis, you're correct. This is at this moment, probably the most reactionary Supreme Court we may have seen since before the New Deal, without an absolute doubt. Going
about
back
100 years almost.
Going back to the Lochner era, and I agree with that. To answer your question about who you call KBJ or Ketanji Brown Jackson, why is she such an anomaly? First of all, I know definitely within the last 50 years, going back to Thurgood Marshall, she is the first Supreme Court nominee who has done any work as a criminal defense attorney. The last time we had one was literally Thurgood Marshall, and that wasn't even the majority of the kind of work that he did. He just happened to do some criminal defense work, okay? KBJ or Ketanji Brown Jackson spent 2 years as a federal criminal defense attorney. Understand, that means massive major drug crimes, RICO case. She's defending serious, high-level federal statute offenders, right? Now, people are like, well, why is that a good thing? Well, what is a good thing is that doesn't mean that she's like, you know, let them loose, let all the criminals out. What that means is that if you look at the overall jurisprudence we've had, particularly from people like Clarence Thomas and Scalia, these are people who will make things like Miranda go away if they had a chance. Their jurisprudence on things like the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, the police abuse of the rights of private citizens in their homes, things of that nature, have been so extreme that they have displaced the normative jurisprudence that we had of these cases that came out of the 50s and 60s. And the fact that Ketanji Brown Jackson is someone who has worked as a defense attorney means that she has been working at least in a legal capacity to fight against that trend.
Right. And in terms of Democratic nominees, too, because she's one of the most progressive we've seen in, you know, a long time, definitely the most progressive in decades, I would agree with you. The fact that she didn't cash in the corporate law firm like a lot of these other Democratic nominees do. And
well, she did some corporate time.
That others did. I mean, there's a lot of Supreme Court, or there's a lot of lawyers that will do a little bit of their time in public works or as a prosecutor, and then they'll cash in at a corporate law firm.
Well, the thing is interesting is she did corporate work, but while she did corporate work, the type of corporate work she did was very counter-majoritarian, even in the corporate capacity. Like, she represented the ACLU. She represented people that were representing, like, people who were being, like, you know, tortured in Guantanamo. So, right. You know, she was very strategic. I mean, this is going to – a lot of my comrades on the left are going to be like, oh, come on, man, you're playing this up too much. But I'm going to be very honest. She carries a comportment – that is more conservative than her legal and jurisprudential experience. In other words, he was very adept. My personal opinion of Ketanji Brown Jackson is that I don't think this is a woman who's some kind of like hardcore right wing hammer and sickle toting leftist. Though that would be great for my politics. I don't believe that. I think that, you know, she comes from a middle class Miami background. Both of her parents were historically black college and university graduates. She grew up, I know where she grew up in Miami. And I believe that she grew up with an understanding that, like, you know, the law, you know, has its good parts, but there are people who are not benefiting from the system. The system is unjust.
I think that is exactly the thing that I think you can see that is reflected in the skepticism she had that led her to become a defense attorney at that time, because she was sitting on a sentencing board.
Oh, this is a very important point. I'm glad you brought that up.
And she realized that I'm only seeing one perspective of this, and I'm not seeing the receiving end. You know, like, she was basically, within the context of our criminal system, she was the rider, and she basically said, well, I want to get the perspective of the horse. And, right. And I think you can see that throughout her career, which in this day and age where you have people who are immersed in, you know, basically their oxygen is comes from one sort of self-enclosed loop that is recycling the air. The ability for her to seek that out suggests to me that her response on the court is going to be essentially, in very broad strokes, for the underdog. And I and if that modus operandi, you know, works not just within the context of the criminal cases that they'll hear, but also in the economic cases that they're going to hear, that's going to be very, very helpful, I think.
Oh, absolutely. No, listen, Lindsey Graham, he said something that was actually true. And the fact that he was pissed off about it actually made me feel good. He was like, yeah, the progressives are really happy about this, but Biden's really got the brand. I was like, yeah, you're right. Because the progressives almost never get a pick that they're happy about. There's no reason to. You compare her to who our current attorney general is, who Obama wanted to pick. And was that Merrick Garland? Garland, I mean, in my circles, he'd be called a right winger.
Right. Right. Just a corporate, straight down the middle corporate, you know.
I mean, I know a lot of people are like, oh, Sotomayor. Sotomayor is not a left justice at all.
No.
Not by any stretch of the imagination. She was a prosecutor. But and even besides that, she did massive amounts of time in corporate firms. And even if you look at her decisions, it's only in the most extreme of cases she dissents. And you look at some of her financial regulatory rulings, it's not exactly particularly left at all.
Right. Right. And and let's just address, because I know this was out there too, that people, you know, question was the there was a case, I think it was with Boeing, and it was a tort. It was a labor law.
Yes, this is really, really.
Go into this, because I've looked at this and I have spent an inordinate amount of time interviewing tort lawyers over the past 10, 15 years. Having had worked with one of the biggest mass torts lawyers in the country, and am very familiar with this branch of the law, more so than I think that my dad would have wanted me to be at one point. But talk about this case, because
this is
being spun in a way that it was problematic, and I actually think that it was not at all.
Who's got problematic at all? I mean, this is a sad reality. First of all, the fact that of all of the complaints that anyone who is left of center has about this woman comes down to one case should pretty much tell you how weak their case is.
Right.
That this is the only thing they can find is this one case. Basically, there was a case, I believe it was against Boeing. It was a major corporation that was engaged in some type of discriminatory or some kind of tort type of legal lawsuit against black employees or black workers. Okay. And she made an adjudication basically that was based on a technical aspect about the size of a class for the case. It wasn't on the substantive merits to say these people are baseless in their suit. Basically, what she was saying is that the way in which the class structured itself would deny other members who potentially could be in the class to become aware of their right to damage. And because of the way she decided the case, it did have a negative effect on those who were the plaintiffs in the case in a certain way. But it wasn't on the substantive merits to say that these people have no grounds to sue or, you know, this is ridiculous. It was basically a technicality around the issue of the way in which a class in a case of that nature is determined.
And my understanding is that the Supreme Court had made it had narrowed the ability of people to form it as a class, and there were actually two aspects of her ruling. One was that based upon the way the Supreme Court had structured it, the 5,600 or so employees wouldn't constitute a class for the purposes of torts, but also people who were included in that 5,600. Were unaware that they had been included in it.
Correct.
And had they gone forward as a class, would have not had the opportunity to pursue their own cases that may be far more egregious than they would have gotten from those 5,600. And you know, and there are times where aggressive tort lawyers want to have as big a class as possible because they want to make some money, and often this is good. Often, you know, sometimes it can be bad. And so that was it. It was a, like you say, not on the merits of what exactly took place between Boeing and these workers.
Is this the Lockheed? Was it Lockheed Martin?
It was Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was a little confused.
I knew it was a an airline. But okay, so be that as it may, we've said that. What are the implications of, well, what are the implications of the pick insofar as, like, all well and good that she is the, but she's going to be writing dissents, right? Like, it's all going to be dissents unless, you know, there's a bus accident at one point or, you know, whatever.
Well, I mean, listen, I don't think we necessarily need to be so kind of a, I mean, these people get old, right? I mean, Clarence Thomas was sick. He was in the hospital. I'm not saying we're wishing death on these people. What I'm saying is that, like, we don't know what could happen. Someone could be sick. Someone could die. Someone could get, you know, there's a variety of things that could happen. Currently, the makeup of the court is 6-3. So she's replacing a judge who is one of the three. So obviously, yes, she's not going to sway the numbers that, significantly at this time. But she's 51 years old. She can easily do another 25, 30 years on the court. You know, we don't know what could happen in, you know, two or three presidential administrations. We don't know what's going to happen under the current Biden administration. I mean, we have a couple of Supreme Court justices who get ill, so on and so forth. Who knows? But in terms of the actual numbers, yes, she will probably be writing dissents. But at the same time, the court is a body. Right. And if she seems like a woman who is very intellectually adept, has a strong mastery of the law. And I would get a sense because of the time in which she grew up, which is basically my time. I think we were very close in the time of we were in law school. I was in law school at Boston University. She was at Harvard. She is cognizant of the shift that the court has taken in the last 50 years. And she's also alive to who Clarence Thomas is. She's alive to who Scalia was. She's alive to what the Rehnquist court was about. And, you know, of course she's not going to say this in terms of her interrogation in front of the Senate. I'm sure she has an understanding of what these people's worldview is. And I'm also sure she's very much prepared to challenge them when she has to.
And compare that to Stephen Breyer, right? I mean, Stephen Breyer was indicative of a really old school mentality from, I think, left-leaning justices that still cling to this mythical notion of the court and its function, as opposed to reckoning with, like, the extreme activist wing of the of judges right now that are wreaking havoc on our institutions, et cetera.
Right. You know, the thing is, all right, I mean, because of my politics as a leftist, someone who has kind of a dialectical materialist, yes, I studied law, but I mean, basically, I look at the law and I look at the judicial system as an institution that's designed to protect capital and the interests of capital, because my analysis tells me that the role of the American government is to protect the interests of capital and not to represent the needs of its people, because if we had a government that represented the needs of the people, we wouldn't have to fight capital so much to protect the needs of the people.
I want to ask you about the political implications of this, but I first have to ask you, did you have Clark Bice at BU?
Clark Bice was my contracts professor.
Clark Bice was my contracts professor there too. I went to BU for a year. When were you there?
I started there in 92. I took some time to get out.
Oh, damn. I was there in 90, and then I left. I only was there for a year. But
I could have been
going at the same time. I had no idea. But Clark Bice we got to talk about that.
Clark Bice, for those people who don't know, allegedly is the contracts professor who the character Kingsfield is based on by the famous movie. What's the name of the movie?
Well, Paper Chase.
Paper Chase.
Yes.
And he literally said that in my class. Here's a dime. Go call your mother. You're not going to be a lawyer.
Yes. 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 He said to me at one point, I raised my hand in class, and he said, I'm not going to call on Mr. Cedar because I know what he's going to say is going to be divisive, insidious, and derisive. And I was always sort of like very I wore that. Obviously, it's one of the few things I remember from
Clark Bice was also the contracts professor for Antonin Scalia.
Yeah.
I actually asked him, I said, what kind of student was Scalia? He's like, I don't think it would be proper for me to talk about that, Mr. Rivera.
Yes. All right. Well, we've got to talk more about that. But give me your sense of the political implications of this pick.
Well, the political implications is that the now we are in a period of the reactionary right. could argue the right has always been reactionary, but we do have a kind of contemporary iteration of the right that is kind of like, you know, to use a slang phrase that's very popular in Miami, off the meat racks, if you will, in terms of the right wing nature of its posturing. And they're going to throw a hissy fit, and I think that they're going to try to maybe in policy or in temperament say, okay, you got yours, and hold this long-term down the line for federal judiciary picks or judicial picks in general. Maybe Biden, if he has a few more picks. Biden has had a in opposition to the way Obama was a snail in picking judges, Biden has been pretty good in filling the seats. In terms
he's at a pace that's even faster than Trump's is my
understanding. Trump was knocking him out the park, as a matter of fact, right? So Biden is doing pretty good, which should be expected, right? The Biden was on the Judicial Committee for like years when he was a senator. So,
and there's also, I think there was a concerted effort. You know, we've interviewed Brian Fallon on this program from Demand Justice, which was brought up as like a boogeyman, and was against Durbin sitting as chair, has been applying pressure. And he was a former Obama, you know, staffer who basically said, we blew it. And in terms of
I hate when they say that stuff. They didn't blow it. They strategically did that to appease the institutions that they were representing, which were the banks and finance capital.
I honestly believe that they were just – They made a political calculation that they did not want to expend their energy on the courts. I mean, we could debate that as to whether, but you know, whether they purposely left you know that empty, and they but they seem wholly unprepared even before they got elected. Maybe that was, but
yeah. Well, listen. We don't have to deliberate on this. I don't cut the Obama presidency was the most curated presidential administration we've had in this country probably in the last 50 years. All right. This guy was created in a petri dish to be president. He had been siphoned off since he was at Harvard Law School. He was hanging out with what's the guy's name who was eventually with the Secretary of Treasury. I forgot his name.
Rubin.
He was connected to Rubin early on. This guy is in 2006. He's going to Rubin's Hamilton Foundation, talking about I have a whole piece I wrote for Black Agenda Report on Barack Obama, Wall Street's perfect Manchurian candidate. This guy was in the pipe long before he became president.
His,
as a matter of fact,
his entire cabinet was outlined by a guy named Froman, who was a Citigroup executive and ended up being the top trade guy. I agree with all of that. But, you know, they could have also put in bank-friendly federal judges, and they just didn't fill any of the seats. I mean, they could have... If they wanted to put in very banker-friendly judges, they could have done that.
I think that you're correct on your face in that regard, but they still had to maintain the charade of with Democrats. You know, like they can only play the game so far. I mean, they could have filled with a bunch of Merrick Garlands.
That's my point. Is that they? That's why I think it was just simply a question of competence and perception of the judiciary, because they could have put in. They could have filled all these seats. They presumed, right? They didn't presume that Donald Trump would get in and have all like 100 of these empty.
I think that was purely plausible deniability for them. You're talking about a guy who was a constitutional law professor. I'm not buying that. They were like, oh, I guess we forgot that the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary is important as a president. After Bush, after all the scandals with the Bush administration right before him, in terms of some of his Supreme Court picks, listen, I'm not saying that they should have revved it up like Trump. But, I mean, these guys understand the way in which, particularly since the rise of Bork and the birth of the Federalist Society, it has been an agenda of the right to stack the courts.
Well, Brian, let's put it this way. Brian Fallon, that's his story. And I think that part of what has been there has been the reason why we're seeing better picks from Biden, which better and more numerous than were under Obama, is a blowback from the Obama administration, and in some instances from people who actually were in were staffed there. Maybe they have their public story and their private story are different. But be that as it may, so let me ask you this: what did you think in terms of the political value, strictly political value, in terms of like the midterm elections? Because my sense is it was an abject failure on part of the Democrats.
I'm going to be very transparent with you, Sam. I think that Biden dropped the ball by making this about identity politics at all in the first place. Listen, if Biden knew that he was going to pick a black woman, he should have never announced it. He said nothing about it, kept it quiet who his pick was. And then when the time comes, boom, that's fine. Because he set her, he basically set her up to be viewed pejoratively without justification. You got degenerates like Tucker Carlson saying, well, I want to see her LSAT scores. I'm like, Tucker, this woman could probably has more intellectual qualifications than you to do your job. You prick.
Without a doubt. And I agree with you. And it was, I mean, he announced this on the campaign trail, and I think it's just it clearly didn't work. I mean, if you look at just numbers, I mean, maybe the Biden would have lost even more, but maybe he needed to do that to like assure, you know, black voters like, hey, despite my history of being, you know, sort of racist-y a little bit, you know, I'm not going to do that. But it seems to me that at least in the context of, you know, why not exceed expectations?
This is a guy who knew at a certain point he was going to have the first black female vice president. Why did he need to play that game?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, I want to we're running close to time, but let's talk a little bit about I had a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about, but that was a fascinating conversation, and not the least of which to find out that you went to BU law school, which is funny. But let's talk a little bit about Adams. You had a piece on the mayor. We were just spoke about him yesterday. He's doing a campaign that involves Florida. He is using New York City tax dollars to rent out 4 billboards in throughout Florida state, the state of Florida. I don't know, maybe it's not that much, and maybe the you know, to criticize the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida that is now law, and to invite I guess gay Floridians or all Floridians to move back to New York, but. Just give us your broad sense of Adams, and maybe you can include your perspective on that.
Well, listen, if you can indulge me with a couple of minutes,
please
talk about Eric Adams. As I did in that piece you saw, the video I did with Ben Dixon, I'd like to put him in the context of the evolution of the black political class in the last 50 years. Real quick, I'm going to try to make it as fast as possible. Hey, if I can do 200 years of Haitian history, I can do this. So in the last 50 plus years, we've had the evolution of the post-civil rights black political class. They've gone through basically 4 iterations of change. The first iteration of the black political class, and what is the black political class? These are the elected officials, as well as the ideological superstructure around the civil rights organizations, the churches, and the membership organizations that create the kind of political options that exist in black communities that channel black voters into supporting traditionally the Democratic Party and largely the more corporate kind of conservative faction of the Democratic Party in exchange for patronage, which I pejoratively call fat back and biscuits that they dole out to their constituencies to maintain that fealty. Okay. So we know Clyburn, the Congressional Black Caucus, the civil rights organizations, the black churches, HBCUs, fraternities, sororities, links, Freemasons, they all make up the ideological superstructure that is the black political class. The first iteration of the black political class in the 70s, because they're coming out of the movement era, black power era, they had to at least have the illusion of redistributive politics. So as a result, you would get, you know, the traditional kind of more neoliberal friendly black mayors, but they had to at least initiate politics because there was still a kind of radical black politics on the grassroots level where they would give people things. And they would basically, like, you get your Maynard Jacksons, Andrew Youngs, and they actually redistributing some policy to people. All right. in the next iteration, you have the urban regimes of the 80s. Because these guys are coming in when neoliberalism is in full swing, they're basically governing cities that are in majority, in austerity. Excuse me. Sam is old enough as I am to remember where there was a time in America where you felt like damn near every city in America had a black mayor. You're like, what's going on here? Like everywhere. New York, Atlanta, Chicago, you had Tom Bradley in L.A. But what happens is that because most of these cities were coming out of economic precarity in the 70s, they had to basically do austerity for working class people and surrender to pro-growth neoliberal policies that helped banking and real estate division. And as a result, because of the economic precarity, increase in mass incarceration because of crime and also the influence of crack, a lot of these guys are overseeing massive mass incarceration in the administration and the cutting of government services for the poor who disproportionately are black people. This is also happening at a time where underclass ideology, which basically renders black poor people to being unable to function in American society, is becoming popular. That's the second iteration of the black political class. Third, we have the rise of neoliberalism with the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, that comes out in the 80s with Clinton, which takes neoliberalism, which is a fancy word for pro-corporate, pro-marketization, pro-capitalist, pro-big business. We get it. Charter schools, et cetera, so on and so forth. Democrats take that and double down on it and, frankly, in some ways do things that are worse than Republicans. NAFTA, GATT, financial deregulation, you name it. I think you guys and your audience are pretty much familiar with that pivot. Black politics is always a reflection of the nature in which capitalism is in American society. And as a result, the black political class, out of fear of Newt Gingrich, pivots and embraces neoliberalism, particularly John Lewis, who people think is a wonderful civil rights leader that Bruce Dixon, my mentor, couldn't stand because he was one of the original signatories of the Democratic Leadership Conference. And no one ever talks about that, as a matter of fact. But moving on, in that period of time, the 25-some-odd year period of neoliberal Democrats, we get the rise of what, you know, some would call the true neoliberal black politicians. As Bruce Dixon and Glenn Fortune tell me, there was a trial balloon of like five candidates to become the first black president, all with the same background. Cory Booker, Adrian Fenty, Hal Ford Jr., Arthur Davis, and Barack Obama. All elite Ivy League or Ivy League proximate, all pro-corporate charter school, all heavily financed by finance capital, and basically they were the model of what was desired to take black politics into a full embrace of this pivot to capitalism that starts in the late 70s, gets worse in the 80s, it gets worse in the 90s, where black politics basically becomes surrendered to serving totally the corporate forces, right? We have Obama. Obama is seen by many people in the black community as a failure. 35% of black wealth lost. No recompense from the Obama administration. You have Black Lives Matter. You have all of these things going on. Black folks getting shot in the face on Facebook, and people are like, what's going on? And all of a sudden, there's this like new rise of black consciousness in the face of this black president who people thought was supposed to be the post-racial president. So what happens is that during that period of time, as we all know, probably one of the reasons we have the rise of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders presents an ideological shift in the Democratic Party in that 35% of the party is hardcore left, embracing socialism. And what happens is that in the face of the rise of this left, even though most black people are not embracing that politics, the black political class is threatened because their whole purpose is to leverage the illusion of racial progressivism that they carry from being the inheritors of the civil rights movement to actually, as a pretext, to cover their fealty to corporate politics. So because you have progressives now, you have AOC, Sanders, who are calling them out, they're in jeopardy. What is Eric Adams, to get to the point? Eric Adams is basically tap dancing, threading the needle between both phenomenon, the neoliberal corporate pro-Wall Street types like the Obamas and the charade and facade of rhetorical progressivism that is popular with the woke kids in order to keep like, yo, I'm a vegan. We can't persecute the gays. I was like, we can't be too hard on drill rap. Come on now. I talk to the kids, which is all a facade because Eric Adams is also highly financed by the real estate development corporations. He's publicly, the New York Post had a really great article talking about Chuck Gasparino. I'm sure you guys know who Charlie Gasparino is. Mm-hmm. Hardcore, blowhard Fox News corporate, you know, Wall Street parasite who was like, yeah, I love Eric Adams. He said, you know, we need more of you Wall Street guys and less of these AOC types. So this is a guy who is purely down with the pro-Wall Street, pro-growth politics. He wants Wall Street to do well in New York, and he's willing to acquiesce to them. But because he understands that him and the black political class are competing with the lingering existing kind of progressive kind of AOC faction. He's got to dance a dance. But because of the COVID crime wave, he's able to come in and say, you know, this soft on crime approach isn't working. And unfortunately, one of the consequences of that COVID crime wave is that I'm worried that the anti-carceral, which basically means the anti-mass incarceration politics that we had started with the millennium, that when people were basically challenging mass incarceration, I think that might go the wayside. And I'll sadly, I think it's possible that we might actually see another reboot of mass incarceration again, if not from Biden, maybe the next president.
Well, that's, I think that's when you say the tough on crime part, that's, I think, the third wrinkle really to him as well, is that he was a cop. He came up with this kind of rhetoric in his political career about being tough on crime, speaking directly to communities about, like, this is why you're not able to get ahead. And I think that that makes him unique, particularly in like this exact period. He might have not been able to win except for in this post-COVID era.
Right.
Let me ask you about that, about where we are, about the fifth iteration, I guess, of the black political class. I mean, I think, you know, there were two moments where I sort of came to the understanding on some level this dynamic of the fourth iteration, like some vote that Gregory Meeks took back in like 2005 or six. When I'm like, wait, what? And then having, you know, a run in with an Obama fundraiser who turned out to be on like what are the, like Forbes top 10 black, wealth guys in the country. And him telling me that the CBC was in favor of rolling back the estate tax. And
right.
wait, what? And because there is a sort of like a, you know, a presumption, or at least there's a projection that these are some of the most progressive members of the Democratic Party. But
they pimp out their allegiance to the civil rights movement, and their members, some of them are actually being members of it, and also the charade, the, you know, the politics, the racial bigotry of low expectations, because you're black, of course you're going to be progressive. You care about the poor. Yeah, don't believe that crap. That's not always the case at all.
No, I understand that at the, you know, at this point, but I think there was, you know, there was a just sort of, you know, default position that, like, if I'm representing Queens, I'm going to be a progressive member of the House. And I'm
The New York City Black CBC delegation, these guys are late with Walt Hakeem Jeffries. Are you joking me?
No. This was, you know, 15 years ago for me when I sort of came to these conclusions. But where are we in that cycle? Like, is there any indication of a fifth iteration of the black political class that is returning to its, you know, maybe
70s version of redistribution? Yeah. I wish I could be so optimistic, because what we're seeing, right, is that there's a generational fracture, schism, if you will. Mm. The under 40 and working class and generational, under 40 black folk, college educated or not, and more working class black people are tired of the symbolism. They're tired of the empty neoliberal politics. They're getting no return on investment for it. And they're more alive to the charade of the symbolism because of the belief in the phase of the Obama presidency. And they're not signing on to it. More black professional managerial class or black petite bourgeois over 45, older 50 types, they're still enamored with the, you know, Ketanji Brown Jackson, you know, pictures of her with, like, you know, the little girls, like, walking to school, but like, oh, one day I can, you know, all of that crap, which, by the way, great book I'm reading right now. We Have No Leaders, African Americans in the Post-Civil Rights Era, Robert C. Smith, who's a political scientist. In this book, he talks about how the Democratic Party strategically realized, particularly in the 80s, that when they were in power, they did not have to worry about giving redistributive policy to black people as long as they used symbolism in leaders or candidates to get black folk to say, like, oh, you know, we're going to have the first black this, the first black that. So this is not an accidental thing. This is a strategy.
Yeah. I mean,
are you saying there was insincerity when they took the knee? when they all took the knee and when Nancy Pelosi took
the kente cloth and Nancy Pelosi and all that. You didn't think – you weren't moved by that, Pascal?
No. I would have been moved, but I don't want to say what I would have been moved to. But anyway.
Your bowels were moved. Sorry, not Sophie. Hey, it's Casual Friday. I mean, I guess like in terms of the intersectionality of the politics, the only person that comes to mind really is Cori Bush is somebody who.
Well, you know, let's be fair. There is some hopes. We have India Walton was the sister from Ohio, Bernie Sanders' surrogate. I can't believe I don't remember
Nina
her
Turner,
name.
Nina Turner.
Nina Turner. I mean, you know, I like Nina Turner. I have some questions about her charter school politics, but she generally is a progressive. The problem I have is that these folks are just getting killed by the black political class, man. They just kneecap them all the time, and they're not really capturing the political imagination of large numbers of black voters. And what's becoming very scary, and I wanted to mention this, right? There is a pivot among a small segment of black folk to actually embrace conservatism, particularly a small coterie of black males who would just feel like the Democratic Party is not talking to them at all, who are really buying this, like, Booker T. Washington, that's up from slavery, you know, pick up your bootstraps, you know, all kind of like, you know, we can do it on our own, don't trust the government politics. Because, I mean, if you ever go on social media and you see the way these young guys, you talk about young men under 30, under 35, are embracing people like Thomas Sowell, Glenn Loud, all these like Manhattan Institute Foundation, Heritage Foundation funded, you know, like mercenaries of black misery who are touted out to appeal to kind of old classical black nationalist notions of like, it was the government that messed things up for everyone. But we were on our own picking cotton. Things were wonderful. You know, these guys who play up on this nonsensical kind of like, you know, romancing Jim Crow idiocy, they have a small resurgence in segments of black constituencies. And I think that one of the things we may have to worry about, don't forget, Trump did get 17% of black male votes. So what I'm saying is that there's a possibility. And again, not to be overly kind of harsh, but the Democratic Party, quite frankly, has done nothing to deal with the material realities of black people in my lifetime, quite frankly. It's been they have more effectively doubled down on the worst of neoliberalism, frankly, particularly in the anti-poverty policies from mass incarceration, gutting the FDC under Clinton, financial deregulation that led to the subprime that black people were devastated with. And the sad reality is that when you have over 90% of the black electorate that is forced into one political party, there's no reason to pay attention to them because they're considered a captive audience.
Yeah, I am reminded of two things. One, I had Glenn Ford on, the late Glenn Ford on the program back in 2012, arguing he had written a piece that
the more effective, the most effective evil.
Yes, exactly. And Marc Maron, who in the run up to the 2008 election had a joke that has always stayed with me about Obama, which was that finally, for the first time in the history of our country, black Americans will have the opportunity to get screwed by one of their own. And
it's not the first time. It's the first time it's made public.
Well, there you go. I mean, it is, I don't know if we're, you know, I wonder if we're going to see, you know, sort of some change in that construct. I guess, you know, I am increasingly of the mind that it's a generational problem on some level, and we're not going to see, you know, that meaningful change for another 10, 15 years, maybe, when we have a different leadership in, you know, both. I mean, in all of these sort of like spheres on some level. And, you know, I guess maybe it's good that we have KBJ there. 20 years from now, she'll be able to hopefully sit on the majority of the court, and they won't block some of these redistributional changes.
Well, I think we on the left, and, you know, or those who are left of center, we have to take some blame because we have not effectively penetrated the ideological superstructures that exist in these communities. I'm not the smartest person in the world who doesn't know this crap. The Democrats know all this stuff. They know how black politics works. Okay? They know how these institutions work. The progressives, listen, Bernie can talk, Bernie knows how this works. His people know how this works.
Well, do you think that they, you know, I mean, there seemed to be some awareness of how to penetrate, but it didn't necessarily wasn't the greatest of efforts. Like, I mean, you know, I think in you know, particularly with like the Clyburns, you know, I don't know how much of an effort was made there.
Well, I mean, listen, it's going to be hard. I think that deconcentrating on the under 40 generation will be the most effective way because they were the ones who were more pro Sanders anyway. Right. And I think that it's going to need recruiting people like Indian Walton, like Nina Turner, or people who are in that line who are more familiar with those spaces, who can actually motivate with a kind of a grassroots appeal to these communities, who know what the black churches are like, who know what the fraternity sorority graduate chapter picnic is going to be like, who know what the HBCU homecoming is going to be like, to actually be able to kind of penetrate this type of politics. It's going to take a lot of work, but I think that the sad condition of the left that we're in today after the 2020 election is that organizing is something like we seem like we've given up and surrendered it to people like Steve Bannon, who's having organizational mechanisms across the country motivate right wingers to, like, you know, gut, you know, teaching black history in school, you know, support, you know, anti-gay, anti-abortion legislation. So people will make the argument that, like, oh, well, political organizing doesn't work anymore and we're beyond mass politics. I find that interesting because it's working for the right. The right is using mass politics and they're doing a great job of it. They're basically taking tactics that the left has used to implement a right-wing agenda.
Pascal Robert, folks can check out This Is Revolution at on YouTube or wherever your podcasts are served.
Yep, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Well, I shouldn't say Spotify. Anything you can find podcast apps at This Is Revolution. And I'm on Twitter at PRobert06 at Twitter. You can Google my work. And
at PRobert06?
Yeah, at PRobert06. The last name 06 is my Twitter handle.
Okay. What happened to you? Was 0-1 through 5 taken?
0-6, it's a fraternity thing. My fraternity was founded in 1906, and that was like our cost line is 0-6, that's why.
All right, got it. All right, well, it was great having you. Really appreciate you coming on. I want to talk to you about the BU Law School someday. I get funny stories about vice. All right, we got to take a little break here. We'll go into the fun half.
Right.
Yeah.
Folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, though you can always go and check out the podcast description. We keep all the deals that you get in there. You also get the fun half, and you get stuff like, did we post it? The Brooklyn Show.
Mm.
Brooklyn Show is up for in
check
the podcast
out that
feed.
Brooklyn Show. First off, you get that really just smear job. I don't even know why we included that. It was ridiculous by Ronald Reagan.
To be transparent.
Yes, that's true. I'm not afraid of those type of smears at all. So we posted that Ronald Reagan smear job he did. The amazing David Feldman correspondence Ukraine. And then we also had Jack Crosby, who had been in Ukraine.
It was also good.
Yeah, but also good. Feldman was more in Ukraine.
We had a comment. I don't want to reveal what happened, but we had a comment from John from San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
We had Gustavo Rivera and Nomi Const and really Matt run. And Brandon were there. And what else? And we had some.
Binder was also there.
Yeah. Matt Binder. That's what I meant.
Oh, that was.
Yeah. Obviously you were there.
I was there. Yeah.
Emma was there.
Mm-hmm.
So check it out, folks. Become a member today. Get that. And I will tell you right now, in terms
Bradley
of Boston,
was there too.
Oh, Bradley was there too. Sorry. Sorry. You popped up. You popped up on stage. You can go into the member feed of that on our blog and watch the video, which will be embedded there. right?
And then the link, it's linked to in the description of the podcast.
Linked in the description of the podcast for members. And I should tell you right now, we are not going to be able to live stream Boston. We can't. The Wilbur does not have the ability to do that. The Bell House developed it during COVID. It didn't exist before. We will not be able to do that at Wilbur. So, majority live.
So, if you want to come, you got to come.
Yep.
I mean, if you want to watch, you got to come. That's
the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
What's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Yeah, Wednesday night we had Wozni Lambrian to talk about the and basketball, talk a little bit about the playoffs, but we also talk about the player empowerment era of players deciding to pick where they want to play and what sort of political activism they want to do, and how that relates to the maintenance of control of the labor force by the NBA capitalists. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game there.
Folks, see you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
Fun.
What is up, everyone?
Fun.
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Fun.
Let's go, Brandon.
Fun.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start
that way. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say.
857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire, Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.